and I'm a little disappointed because they're all, every time one of the Chasteens preaches, he brings this posse. You ever notice they bring relatives and everybody? And I've never had a posse, so I've got a posse. Robert and Rosa came, and you know, I'm going to count you as part of my posse, which means you got to be here every time I'm here. Yeah, all right, okay. So I'm going there, and I'll just have to tell the Chasteens that they're not the only posse people. Well, as you'll remember, I'm doing the neglected stories of Jesus this year. We've been through a number of them, some of them a little bit of length, some of them quite short, and today's is the shortest, okay? The neglected stories of Jesus. These are stories that don't get much play, okay? We don't hear many sermons about them. And by the way, I'm pretty sure the only reason Robert is here is he's here to steal sermons from me. So this is going to be a tough one to steal, okay? All right. But if you can do it, more power to you. Okay. All right. They just don't get much play. They're on first reading, seem to be very simple, but really have a deeper meaning. And they remind us of the nature of Jesus while he walked upon the earth. So, anyway, our story is in Matthew, the chapter 9. Now, I didn't put that citation exactly right for a reason. You know, the Lord didn't make the chapters. That was added later after the Bible was codified. But sometimes chapters don't break at the right place. And you probably, as you would read this, wouldn't think that that was the case. But I'm going to tell you, these verses are at the end of chapter 9, and we're going to slip over into chapter 10 and 1 for my purposes anyway. So there we go, the plentiful harvest. And Jesus went throughout all the cities and villages, teaching in their synagogues and proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom and healing every disease and every affliction. This takes place early in Jesus' ministry. He has just called his 12 disciples, and he has got them together. They are probably with him, and he's traveling throughout Galilee, his home area, preaching. Now, one of the things we miss, I think, from the New Testament, which archaeology has taught us, is Galilee was a very mixed area. Okay, the more prosperous cities were Greek cities. Okay, the less prosperous cities, generally speaking, were the cities we read about in the Bible, Nazareth and Cana. But we don't read much about these Greek cities because Jesus was going to his people. He called it the lost house of Israel. And he was teaching. Okay, now you'll notice it doesn't say preaching. It doesn't say evangelizing. It says teaching. And he was doing it in their synagogues and proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom and healing every disease. So we see this very personal ministry which Jesus has with kind of his home area, okay, his home people, okay. He is relocated evidently to Capernaum, but he still has family back in Nazareth. He went to the wedding at Cana. He's been to many of these places, and he's going around preaching the kingdom. Okay. And so this is a very personal thing, but it's not enough. Okay, it's not enough. It does not fulfill his whole purpose here. Okay, and I want you to remember that as we go through. And when he saw the crowds, he had compassion for them. So because they were harassed and helpless and like sheep without a shepherd. So we can imagine that he goes to a synagogue, and he's a big-name preacher, okay? Everywhere he goes, he's got crowds. You remember the woman bumps up against him to get healed and all this, and he has to get away, and he has to feed them more than once because they're out in the country. Biggest name in town, I guess. You know, this is the best show. This is better than Titanic or, you know, something. This is big, so that there's all these crowds. And you can imagine, most synagogues were probably just one room. They had some little closet kind of areas, the ones that they've excavated. And you can imagine that not everybody could fit in the synagogue when the big-name preacher shows up. Okay. We saw this, you remember the other story where they had to let their friend down through the ceiling because they couldn't get into Jesus. And we're imagine this. And we can also imagine maybe some of the rulers of the synagogue are going, well, these people, you know, when I'm here, nobody's here. Look around you. I have the same feeling right now. All right. Y'all tell your friends, okay? Tell the people that skipped today, that went on vacation. Okay, and you know, and here they are, and then this guy comes in, and look, there's all these people, and some of these people haven't even been coming to synagogue. They're not living the right kind of lives. They're not worshiping. They're not living godly lives. And Jesus was happy to have those people. In fact, those really were the people he was after, because he knew that the kingdom of heaven would be built on those kind of people, not on the people that held to the religion of their day. Everyone would have to be changed, but this was his emphasis. But isn't it interesting? They were harassed, okay? Now, they were economically disadvantaged, okay? They were overtaxed. Okay, the Romans and even the Greek culture which they existed in put them at the bottom of the social scale. Okay, their religious leaders in Jerusalem weren't particularly interested in them. You know, when Jesus gets down there, you remember they kind of talk bad about Galileans. They recognize that Peter, by his brogue, is a Galilean. Okay, and so these are people kind of on the low end of the cash flow scale. Okay, they're harassed. When they have dug up their houses, they find out that they had families in little bitty houses, not as big as this area inside these four columns. Okay, you talk about a lack of privacy. You got 8 or 9 people living there, sleeping in there. You got no privacy. They're harassed. They were helpless. Okay, there was nothing for them to be able to climb out of their poverty or their oppression. There just wasn't anything. Okay? And of course, Jesus was the answer, but he wasn't the answer the way they may have wanted it. And then it says right there, they were like sheep without a shepherd. And we kind of know what that means. When Jesus gets down to Jerusalem, you know, it's all intrigue and with the Romans and, you know, all this stuff going on. And the people that the religion was supposed to speak to were just kind of left alone, ignored, like sheep without a shepherd. Before we go on, I've got to tell you, I see a little bit of this in churches today. Okay, I've got to be true to you. Okay, y'all all need to turn around here and look at some ears. Thayer, have your brother stand up. This is why, stand up. Yeah, this is what I got to put up for. I look out into the audience, and there I see it. Okay, all right. So you can take those off now. Okay, there you go. All right. So you know, so many people find themselves either alienated from religion, or in a religion that really has no power, a religion that doesn't change, that doesn't even require to change lives. Okay? And so I see a little bit of this going on today. You know, people that are able to get by in Christianity without being Christ-like. And so we need to remember this as we see this story, that Jesus didn't like that. He didn't like the fact that these Galilean brothers and sisters of him, neighbors, people from the next town over were in this situation. Amen. Okay? But here's the interesting thing about this story is, he's not going to solve this. He's not going to do anything about it. Well, that's not exactly right. But he's not going to do anything about it the way we might expect somebody who is both a God and a man, who is both human and divine, who can work miracles, can heal. He's not going to do that. Okay? This is a problem which is beyond what he is willing to do in his ministry. And this resounds down to our day. So here we are. Jesus is going. Itinerant preacher. You can imagine he's one Sabbath. He's in one town. Maybe he stays two Sabbaths. Who knows? Goes around. Maybe drops into Nazareth to see the family. Whatever. But during the whole time, there is this incompleteness. And we don't normally think of Jesus, do we? Okay. Because he's among people that need help, but he is not going to be the one that helps them in a very special way. Now don't misquote me here, okay? And if you quote what I said, you're misquoting me. Jesus is going to do this, but it's not in the way that we might expect him to do it, okay? And this is the lesson for us, okay? And then he said to his disciples, so he's called these 12 guys. He says, the harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few. And I'm going to say we understand the situation in which he is saying this, but I'm going to tell you there has probably never been a time in the church's history where this wasn't true. Okay. There's always been people who have needed the Lord. There have always been more people that needed the Lord than there are people to bring the Lord to them, and we need to be aware of that constantly in our lives. The harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few. Therefore, so you got Matthew, Mark, Peter, Andrew, James, and John. I was singing the wrong song there. I was singing the books about Peter, Andrew, James, and John, Philip, and... Yeah, there we go. You know, and he's saying the harvest is plentiful. There's a lot of fruit out there to be picked. There's a lot of grain out there to be cut and brought in. There's all this stuff, and we haven't got enough people to do it. When I lived in Idaho, I met a number of farmers who were big-time wheat farmers. And you drive out in southern central Idaho around Pocatello there, and there are these great big wheat farms. One guy farmed 9,000 acres. Okay, now that, I don't know how much y'all know about agriculture, but that's a lot. My granddaddy farmed 160 acres. Okay, now of course he did it with a mule and later with an old John Deere tractor. You've seen these, he had a farm, what is it? But that's a lot of wheat. And in Idaho, the winter comes early and you got to get it in, and there's a very small period between the time that your wheat is able to be harvested and before you can expect to freeze and your wheat to be ruined. Okay, so they ran these big, these were Case models, but they had John Deere's too, these big articulated four-wheel drive, except they've got two of those great big tires on each wheel, so it's really eight-wheel drive tractors, you know, 180, 200, 225 horsepower, big old suckers to harvest their wheat, and this guy owned nine of them. Okay, and the reason he owned nine of them, he didn't need nine to harvest his wheat in the few weeks that he had it, but he couldn't afford a breakdown. Now, I don't know how much these things cost, but I'm going to guess $250,000 a piece. So this guy has got millions of dollars in tractors because he can't afford a breakdown. He can afford a breakdown in May or January, but he cannot afford a breakdown in late August, early September. Okay. So he had more tractors than he needed because the harvest was so plentiful and the time was so short for him to get it in that he needed them. And basically Jesus is saying, we got 9,000 acres of wheat and we've only got that one farm all that John Bannister's granddad farmed 160 acres with. It's not going to work. There, you just can't get there. Okay. How old is your tractor, Paul?
It's at least 25.
Yeah, so you understand what I'm saying about it. My guess is every once in a while you got to work on it. Yeah, that's right. This is how the modern day gentleman farmer does. He goes out to do something, works on the tractor all day, and gets it done the next day. Yeah. You can't afford. Well, that's the situation they're in. But it's not wheat. It's not grapes. It's people that are lost. People that need the kingdom. And we got a bigger job than we can handle. And we go, how can Jesus have a bigger job than he can handle? Well, I'm going to submit to you that Jesus has always had a bigger job than he can handle in the way we're talking about. Okay? So, Matthew, Peter, John, Thaddeus, all you guys, pray. Okay. And isn't it interesting? He calls God the Lord of the harvest. The person that is really in charge of getting all this gospel preaching, soul saving, life changing, kingdom of heaven stuff going in Jesus' home area so that it can go down to Jerusalem and Samaria and to the ends of the world. Okay. And he calls him the Lord of the harvest. Now, probably this is a reference to a town would grow whatever it is they grow. Let's just say, yeah, they had wheat. Okay, they would have wheat. And what they would do is, the towns, people kind of lived together, and then the fields were out here. Okay, they didn't have the homes on the particular plots like we do now. And then when it came time to harvest, they would all get together and go through the fields and harvest with each other. Similar, I guess, to see you now, you see the big combines just come through and harvest, but this was local, and one person would be in charge of this, and I guess make the decisions of, well, we're going to go to this one, and then we're going to go to that one, we're going to take a break, we're going to do, he was kind of the, we might even call it the mayor of the harvest. Okay, Boaz had a similar function. And remember back in the book of Ruth, you know, they were harvesting, and he says, Ruth, you stay over in my fields. Don't go over in these other fields because we're going to give you extra gleaning. So anyway, so he says, pray to God, pray to the Lord of harvest that he may send out laborers into the field. Because this is what Jesus is lacking. Laborers. People to go out and do the harvesting. Now, we're not talking about wheat. Okay? We're not really talking about teaching. We're talking about evangelism, aren't we? Okay. So, we can imagine, maybe one of the 12 got up and led a prayer. Maybe Jesus led a prayer. Maybe they did it in their private prayer time and they prayed. Don't you imagine? If Jesus told you to pray that you would do it, there's God send out laborers into your field. And that the chapter ends. Okay? And I am unsatisfied with that, so I have obliterated that chapter ending, and we're going on next. And the very next thing is, and he called to him his 12 disciples. These are the same guys who have just prayed, Lord, get us some laborers. And guess who the laborers are? Have you ever had this happen? Probably when you were a kid, you know. I remember I went to my dad. I was about 16 or 17. I said, Dad, I want a car. Can I have a car? And he goes, yeah, you can have a car. You got money to pay for it? Wasn't what I had in mind. I had in mind that Daddy would get me a car. Well, Daddy never did get me a car. Okay? I'm not sure whether I agree with that or not, but that's what's going on here, isn't it? Okay. You guys, you pray for the Lord of harvest to send out laborers, and the very next verse is, you're the laborers. And he gave them authority over unclean spirits to cast them out and to heal every disease and every affliction, and sends them on what we commonly call the limited commission to these areas to do the things, okay, to do the things that needed to be done for the harvest because Jesus wasn't going to do it. Okay. Now, does that mean Jesus stopped teaching, stopped healing? No, I don't think so at all. But he just means this. From the beginning of the New Testament till today, the Lord has always relied on his people to get his work done. And we are very happy to have other people do that. Just as we can imagine Thaddeus saying, "This is great. Yeah, let's get some more help. We got to get some more people in. We got to do a little hiring. Okay? We got to do a little hiring." No. You're the hiree. You are the worker. You are the one that I am going to send out. Now, let's real quickly ask an unanswerable question. Why didn't Jesus just do it all himself? Well, you know, he's got a body like ours. He can only be in one place. But I think it's more than that, isn't it? Jesus knew that I've got this kingdom. I've got this church that I'm building. And guess what? I'm not going to be here for most of the life of this church. I'm going to be at the right hand of God. I've got to build something which can last, which can continue, which can keep going. And the nucleus of that building is these 12 guys who initially think that they're praying for some more hiring going on, and they're not. They're the ones that have been given the job. So, let's take that about 2,000 years later. Let's take that to today. Okay. Walk any direction from this building, 10 blocks, and count the people that are lost. Well, don't walk that direction. That's kind of fast. But you can walk this direction, you can walk this direction, you can walk this direction. Walk 10 miles and count the people that are lost. People maybe they go to church every once in a while, but it hasn't changed their life. Maybe they have no idea what church is. Maybe they don't know who Jesus is. There's a lot of people out like that. Maybe they have a negative view of Christianity for whatever reason. I'm going to tell you, it's been my experience that there's more people like that now than there was when I was, say, Hannah's age. Okay, I can remember on my street, I knew where everybody went to church, and I knew the ones that didn't go to church, the one down the policeman, he would park his car in front of the thing, and he didn't go to church, and I knew that, and I often wondered why a policeman didn't go to church, but it turns out he was. But you know, we just kind of knew that thing. And that's not true now, is it? Okay. The harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. Okay. And guess what? The workers is you. Or as Pogo said, we have seen the problem and he is us. Okay, all right. So three lessons. Jesus needs help to spread the gospel. Now, this is not help on your own. This is not only help doing things like going to Portugal. It's help going to next door. It's help changing the view of Christianity today from a negative to a positive one. It's helping doing all those things which attract people not to us but to Jesus. He needs help, and we don't entirely understand it. Why, Lord, why didn't you just make everybody good and we wouldn't have to mess with this stuff? Well, that's not what happened. Okay, and you can worry about it all your life, but it won't do a bit of good. You can't change it. Okay, people are sinful and they need the Lord. Okay, and it is our job to support that. Maybe it's our job to support it with money. Maybe it's our job to support it with encouragement. Maybe it's our job to get up and go. There's all different kinds of ways, but when we see it as somebody else's job, we forget the lesson of this very short passage. Prayer's the first step. Okay, you got to be prepared. Okay, and you get prepared by pre-praying. That's Peter Piper. That's you try to say that. You get prepared by pre-praying. Okay, you get prepared by pre-praying. Getting yourself in sync with God's will is the first step. Okay, if you aren't in sync with God's will, you're going to be walking uphill all your life. Okay? You know, people say, I'm having so much trouble running. I said, why don't you just run downhill all the time? Yeah. Well, you know, it doesn't work that way, does it? You'll never get home if you run downhill all the time. Okay. Prayer is the first step. And finally, be careful. Prayer can be kind of dangerous. Prayer can kind of trick you. Prayer can kind of bring you to a state that you didn't intend to be in. Prayer can take away that self-satisfaction, that feeling that I'm okay, that I don't need to do anything because I belong to the Lord, because you may be the answer to your own prayer. Okay. And I'm going to tell you, you won't find me preaching against prayer except this. If you're not ready to be the answer, you may not ready to be the prayer.